So, hi, Nick. Welcome to the Life and Recovery Podcast.
Hi, John.
How are you?
I'm really well. I'm just trying to be busy with life and life stuff, kids,
Yes.
but apart from that, I'm really well.
Good. 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 So, do you want to get us started then, with your background, like where you're from and what your kind of story of addiction, is, and how you ended up in recovery and what your life's like now?
No worries. I could sum my addiction up in one word, but I'm not going to swear. I'm going to keep it clean.
You can swear if you want.
I suppose we need a lot longer, would you know, to talk about my addiction and where it started. But like a lot of people from a young age, my addiction started from a young age, and it was, I think I was addicted to attention. I was. When I look back and think, well, I was addicted to attention, whether it's good or bad. Always needed to be the centre of attention and probably suffer out less than all. So the main thing, main started. I remember taking acid at the age of 11. At the age of 11, left school, officially left school, but at the age of 11, it stopped knocking on our door. So at the age of 11, I had a lot of time on my hands. I got into the wrong crowd. I started taking mushrooms, dropping acid, smoking cannabis, drinking. From the birds blue, probably not old enough to remember that ruins.
I am. am.
Yes, my addiction starts at illicit drug starts up in your bed. But life before that was, life was always difficult. I come from a very kind of destructive background, not because my parents were bad people, it's just that they never had I don't believe they had tools to deal with. Kids never had the emotional tools to deal with bringing children up. So they had their own issues with alcoholism and mental health. I've talked to my neighbour, but no one goes confused growing up. So I come from an Irish family. There's more prejudice on the level against people. And my older brother, Paddy, he's half Pakistani. And my stepdad, he's a black man. And I've got an Irish family who don't love black people or Pakistanis. And he's like, he got all confusion growing up, he was. Yes, found drugs at a young age and we were drug fun. I found drugs to do a lot for me, indeed. The drugs to a lot for me inside. And I had a real bad speech impediment growing up, so I had to go to speech therapy. And the more I went to speech therapy, the less I could talk, I find. When I took drugs, John, it wasn't bothered by talking, wasn't interested in talking, wasn't interested in nothing. Drugs just made me feel okay. And the progression from, I was committing crime at the age of 11, like the young age I was. And it just, that's all I could just sum it up, I could go into detail, so I thought it was just shit.
11 years old is young to be doing any drugs, but especially dropping acid. I mean, Jesus.
Yeah, that's
Yeah.
those men, obviously we didn't understand the severity of addiction. We had no idea. We just know it. Obviously, when you have behavior problems, when you well, I don't know, when you come from an household, what's not so functioned doesn't function as everyday people do, and that kind of if you put into the naughty class at school. Will repeat kids who have problems, then what creates a bigger problem? Then you end up mixing kids who have problems. And so I was for all the brothers as well, so it was all kind of, it was all doing the same. And I've gone to my brothers. I was 16 when I found everyone. And a bit some people say when you find everyone, it's like being old, but it made me feel nice, it did. It made me feel nice. It was kind of a feeling I was looking for many years. And it made me sick at first, and that feeling was kind of undeniable. I'll never forget when I first met God, I was 16. It was on a Wednesday afternoon. I went to the Army Careers to join the Army. And I'd done an assessment, and they said, you're underweight. And I'd had no schooling either. So I was going to survive in the Army. And I don't like being told what to do either, so I've never stood a chance. So I've walked out the arm crates on a Wednesday, and I've just never started. I can't pull makes into one basket, but I wanted to be slower, because I wanted some structure, I wanted some to belong. And I left the arm crates, and it's the first time I smoked everything. But, and it took all them feelings about the insecurities, inadequacies, loneliness, despair. And that just carried on. Then crack one the thing when I was 17. And yeah.
Very young, really young, isn't it? I mean, I've got a 15-year-old daughter, and just the thought of like of taking heroin at the age of 16, it's just so young. I mean, taking heroin at any age isn't great, is it? But it's just so young. It's just so young, and it's like, you know, it's just like the it doesn't give you a chance, does it, at that age?
So I think when you look back and you look at change, and I suppose I wouldn't change a thing now. I wouldn't change a thing. So I've got to a place in my life where I'm happy. And I thought, if I went back and changed something, I might not be where I am today. And
Yeah.
where I am today, so I don't want to change, or wouldn't change it for the world. But and obviously we know with addiction, a lot of dishonesty, a lot of thieving. I was one of the first PPOs in Birmingham. I was about 19 or 20. Yeah. 19, I first went to prison. I first experienced my first cold turkey falling in prison at 19. Young offenders, and you never got no con, you never got nothing for detoxing. Wouldn't give you a paracetamol, they wouldn't. And it was really brutal. I remember asking a doctor, young offender, saying, "Can I have a paracetamol? Can we be cold turkey tonight? You know, get out more room, young kid." But going over 20 odd years ago, you really kind of. I'll never forget it, so I experienced my first withdrawal and experience and feelings what I've been escaping for all them years. Going back to the old place, it was really insecure, really kind of damaged, really broken, and not understanding more, not having anybody or any answers to kind of understand. I just had no understanding. I was in a big world, with no kind of life skills, no kind of ability to understand how I should be feeling, what feelings are, and disappointment and water. And I know that when I took drugs, it kind of made it easier. I didn't want to understand that really. And all them years, it kind of compromised the means to escape, suppress, and avoid.
How long did you use from that point when you went to prison the first time at 19? How long was your addiction career? How many years were you in active addiction?
Class A, so from the age of, and I finished at the age of 33. So I think, but from like looking, I think I was really fortunate to finish at that young, so young,
Yeah.
33, and I've got quite a fighting chance to kind of salvage some life and a career and a family. And and with that, look, lots of freedom, lots of swear, lots of upsets, lots of harm to people around me, lots of harm to the criminal justice system, community. So, if I make amends and I need to come about 5 million, I'll probably equal the books a world. Just about.
Have to freeze you in cryogenics and wake you up in the future.
Yeah, so I don't think my story's unique. I don't think so. And that's when we spoke, and I think I think now it's really good now we have a platform to speak openly about where you come from and what. But my opinion, obviously, from the act before 11, before Chuck Fields, my opinion is a lot of physical abuse, a lot of sexual abuse, a lot of emotional kind of psychological, emotional, unintentional emotional abuse. And so that was the picture before then. But if you want to find the substance, it was I've landed on
Yeah.
top.
Well, I mean, the thing is, the reason why I was interested in having a conversation with you as well is because, you know, the public's view, the general view of a typical heroin addict, heroin and crack addict, and, you know, what becomes of those types of people is not your story. And, you know, you're kind of the one in, maybe one in a million that, well, certainly one in the few hundred thousand that actually gets clean and turns a life around, which is pretty miraculous, really. I mean, considering that you had all that trauma growing up, and then, you know, you've obviously you found the drugs. The drugs have served as serve the purpose as the medication, you know, to that trauma. It's like, how do you live a life in recovery without the drugs and dealing with all those emotions and all those mental health issues that you've already mentioned? You know, that's the bit that I find, you know, really, really special in anybody's story of recovery. And yeah, so how, so where did it go from there, from the age of 19?
Yeah, 19 was a lot of their moms I spoke about to society, to the police, to criminal justice system, a lot of crime, a lot of prison, in and out. I went sitting in prison with drinking. How did it come to this? I ended up back in prison because I'm sure 3 months ago when I left, I was adamant I wasn't going to use drugs. I swear to God, I wasn't going to use drugs. And just that revolving door, that vicious cycle. Well, I just couldn't break. And it was when I met, but kind of I met somebody else who was in recovery, which I think was a turning point. We turned life around. It was kind of paying taxes seemed surreal to me. So pay taxes. I met somebody else in recovery, John, and they kind of give me a hug. Give me a hug, and I can never remember having a hug. I couldn't. No, growing up, I never having a hug. Having a hug, it was. It was somebody who kind of experienced a similar background to me, life to me, and was living life without using any substances and going to work and being nice to people and investing in the community, making amends. And it was really attractive, it was. And I thought, I want some of that. So I was 33. I was 33 when I got, when I was, I went into treatment. I went into 12 weeks in treatment and I said, thanks a lot and we'll take care. And I'll come out and petrified. Petrified. I had no life skills. Couldn't wash, couldn't cook. I could clean. So when you go to prison, young offender, many years back, you have to clean, you have to use your governors and you have to make bed packs. So I'm kind of, I had no life skills and I was absolutely petrified. And I found a group of people, I found a group of people who kind of went to meetings and they kind of live with life on life's terms without using substances and kind of, and that's where I met that guy. And he was kind of what he had was really attractive. And he said, not only do you have to hurt anybody else, not you don't have to hurt yourself anymore. And he kind of really took me under his wing a bit and showed me, you know, I screamed at him, I cried at him, I kind of shouted and the early recovery, I just woke up, I went to sleep at a young age and I woke up at 33. It's like I hadn't matured, I hadn't developed, I hadn't. And I cried a lot, shouted a lot, screamed a lot. Yeah, that's that. I met a group of people. It was like living life and he was doing stuff. And somebody mentioned to me, how about volunteering, Nick? And I went, I said, I didn't work for money, I'm not going to work for nothing.
It's a standard answer, isn't it?
Serious answer. And he went, how about giving something back? Because you've kind of taken, you took all your life, haven't you? I mean, the concept of that cut me deep, it did. And it really cut something. But it touched a nerve what I'd never been touched before. So I had a life where I didn't have that much. I just didn't want to, it's all about me. And it touched a nerve. And I thought, yeah. And I started volunteering, I did. I come out of treatment, I fairly free. Started volunteering. I found out that this kind of love and addiction to help people. It was most selfish thing I've ever had in my life. An addiction to help people. It kind of made me feel really good. And it kind of, people say, that's your self-esteem, though. It's building, it's food for your self-esteem, helping others. Couldn't read and write. I never had much kind of humility to tell people at the age of 33, but I couldn't read and write, so I hadn't been to school. That same guy, he went, have I gone to college? And my first answer response was, yeah, I'll do it next year. I'll do it next year. Well, when I'm getting clean, do it next year. He took me to college that day. My first birthday in recovery, 34. So, what do you want to do for your birthday? Well, I don't know what you do for your birthday. I thought, well, I spent it in prison. I didn't know what you'd done for a birthday. I took it to college and I did a diagnostic course. So I'm enrolled in English and maths. And my first day at college, petrified again. But he scores did with anger and dirty looks or whatever. He scores from the inside, I was just absolutely mortified. And so I started using the class with lots of foreign nationals and learning how to speak English. And I loved it. I love learning. I think I find learning really painful, really difficult, but also find it really kind of appealing. Not just that, you've got learning is a lot more new cracking over than it was. I studied and I learned, and I kind of I say, can I articulate myself if I go for a job interview? I can want to speak in a manner where they previous that he knows what he's doing, man. And I don't want to do by the way. Yes, but I made up for lost time, John. Tried to make up for lost time with a lot of chase and a lot of education. I went to college and I was volunteering at college and I was occupied. So, plan for me, but when I stopped taking drugs, I had lots of time on my hands with me. It was like always me and me what used drugs together. It was always me and me what committed crime together. And it was always me and me who ended up in the shit together. So, me and me was not like a good recipe. And I find when I was busy, when I was doing stuff, fulfilling stuff, love self, fulfilling stuff, my self-esteem, I was okay. And that's my early recovery when I've done a lot of stuff to distract myself from myself. But I wasn't a nice person. I hear people say, you've got to get clean for yourself and you've got to do it for yourself. And I'm like, man, I'm a piece of shit, I am. I'm not worth getting clean for. It wasn't the case, and I felt really sad years and years of shame and guilt and regret. Rolling years doing that, knowing somewhere inside that was a better person. Somewhere inside was a better person. He wanted to do good, he wanted to be. Never wanted to be a millionaire. I kind of had enough wisdom to know I'd be dead if I was a millionaire. But always wanted a family, always wanted a family, always wanted to own. Always wanted to say, I've got a 12-year-old daughter and a 3-year-old son now. And the thought of them ever doing anything but it doesn't petrifies me. My
Yeah.
child didn't swear, she didn't, she's not complete opposite. She's really nice. And it's going back, more spoke to you about where I come from to where I am and that kind of journey. That would be if I was spoke about your old journey and kind of there's nothing so far really about the drugs. Took a lot of drugs, I injected a lot of drugs and drank a lot of drugs and all that. I think the important part is that when I'd had enough, 33, something happened where I went out and I found. But I'm from Handsworth, so I grew up in Neatshorns, moved to Shoreditch a few years, and moved to Handsworth when I was 15. I lived around Handsworth till 15. On and off till 33. And yeah, we've all need the best crack at 3 o'clock in the morning. We go out to the phone, the best crack at 3 o'clock in the morning. When I was 33 and I got clean, I went out and found the best recovery, found the best people who were practicing, being good, being the opposite to. And that's what the pinnacle. Well, it wasn't that. I don't believe people are addiction of that.
No.
The word loving, I think we're really kind, we're compassionate, we think we have this very deep level of empathy. What can be detrimental at times, but we feel and that's what the platforms talk about, where people can see other people. I've got clean, I've got my life around, and anything I could do to help somebody else to see, you don't need to go to the end, you don't need to go to that kind of destitute, all that stuff. Give it away. We did kind of, we did get well. We can't turn our lives around. We're not this rich off. There's a lot of people with me off for many years. And my older brother, is also in recovery. He is. Been in recovery for about 7 years. He's got two kids. He's got a beautiful partner. He's got a job. It's a match for really melts my heart. He's also got a niece and nephew. And so when all got clean, he probably seen me. See me doing what I'm doing. That's the part of finding a place where people go and they don't use. You know, You must have a beer on a weekend or whatever. And I couldn't remember, look, when I used to come out of prison, I used to have a beer. I'd end up smoking crack and back in prison. So I just don't, I don't risk it, man. And also, these types, these people don't risk it either. Just get, they get up in the morning. So, today I'm not going to do, I'm not going to use. Now, look, I'm not going to use the shirt. So, today I'm not going to use them. You see me, these couple of years, you must look, the evidence is there. You can't, you've got yourself sorted out. And I have another two brothers, one brother, he's still very chaotic from books and that. And he had a two knife, more than a knife, and he died when he was in active addiction. He got messy, he was found dead in Handsworth Cemetery, and he'd been there for a while, and big investigation. And stuff, so a lot of hardship. So, except for me and my older brother, both used to be in the country, and both used to got kids, and we have a lovely relationship. Quite beautiful.
When you talked about when you mentioned about the group that you go to, I'm presuming that you mean NA, not Narcotics Anonymous.
I didn't know the relate to you were supposed to mention it. Yeah, I went to
Yeah, I
try.
mean it's up to you, isn't it? It's up to you whether you wanna talk about it or not. I mean, I think personally for me, I think this is a platform to, to say exactly how it worked, because people listening to this would will think, okay, so you met these group of people when you were come out of rehab, and then next thing you're clean and you're living this life. Like, how the hell did you actually do that?
No, of course, he got his pay, he got a good life. He ain't told us how he done it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, he wasn't. And I suppose I went to the 12-step fellowship, and something I'd heard about, and I've seen on telly, and I went to NI meetings, I went to AI meetings, I went to meetings, and I'd do my stuff in the daytime, my volunteering, my college. And I made a meeting every night. I made a meeting every night. I'd watch people, and my real people watch that. Love watching people. I love, especially when I saw the nice coffee shop and I watch people. So I heard about these places where people go to meetings. It's just for recovering addicts and they'll get to help each other. And the first, I was really, really lucky. The first meeting I went to, this guy in the main chair, he spoke. And he spoke about where he come from. He spoke about lots of abuse, sexual abuse, his parents in psychiatric units. And he was 6 years clean. At this time, 6 years clean, thought, wow. And the identification, and he just thought it was up to us. It was up to the family people, the group of people like me who've been called to some real dark, desperate places like me. It was smiling, and I was going for food, and there was laugh, having belly laughs. I don't think I've had a belly laugh, and we're all to into a meeting. And you'd have a break and say, and I've got a sponsor involved. My sponsor, he's local sponsor. He was like my CPN, he was like my support worker, he was like my mum, my dad. He was everything to me, he was. Just had, yeah. Inside of saying he loved me, so I didn't love myself. It took me a long time to get kind of to a place where I'm okay, I feel okay. He's done that. He loved me, took care of me, he suggested what to do, what I should be doing. And I went to his house once and cooked the steak. He'd be, wow, how do you know how to cook? Yes, I went to the 12-step fellowship on Earth, and that's the only place where I kind of, I've come out of prison 20 plus times I've walked out of prison all over the country, and I thought, I'm not going back, I'm not going back, I'm always going back. This time I walked out of a 12-week stint in rehab, and I went to a meeting. It's the only thing that's been different. Nothing happened. The only thing happened, the only thing that's been different. In that meeting, I went to a big talk about stuff I needed to hear, answers, like to kind of learn some answers what I needed. But George, once you have that first one, you're not stopping. We need each other. We need other people to help us, because on your own, you're the last person you ever use me, and it's always me. I'm always going to be the last person you use me. But I'm glad I can mention, I'm happy I can mention that I went to an eye. I found out that I made lots of new friends, I made lots of friends. He took me to college. He helped me enroll in college. He kind of helped me when I cried, when I was angry at the world, and I kind of got a lot of early corruption, got a lot of self-pity, a lot of kind of regret, and a lot of stuff that didn't belong to me, having a lot of stuff that wasn't mine. And that kind of helped me when he accepted me. And not in place. He's the only people who accepted me was prison.
It's amazing, isn't it, really, that you know that what you get from going to meetings, like people that aren't in addiction, who obviously don't need to go to any type of fellowships, it's very difficult to explain to them what exactly it is that you get from going to the meetings. But you kind of just said it there, really, is that you hear what you need to hear. And often it's like, it's not only that you hear what you need to hear in the sense that you hear some good stuff. Often it's like you can be in a really shit place and you go to the meeting and you hear exactly what you need to hear, like as though that meeting was set up for you and the universe talks to you through either one or multiple people, and it really, really helps you. And that happens like so often. I mean, it happens. I mean, you hear it all the time. It happens to me so often. Usually, especially when I don't want to go, when I'm like, when I'm kind of kicking my heels a little bit, and I'm like, oh, I'm a bit tired, or I can't really be bothered going tonight. I always just park that and get to the meeting, and then, yeah, I'm usually hit with exactly what I needed to hear.
Yeah, think about the universe has a way of aligning itself. And the first few years I went to, and I people held me, people carried me, people, friends loved me. I've never been abroad in my life, and it's friends who took me abroad with them and advised me to their family, all that stuff. When I got clean, I had a post office card to my name. I didn't have any ID, I didn't have a bank account, I had nothing. And everything I've got through friends I made through that. So this is anything, but I think I was up, and also after a while, when I had them times, you know, my story of going to a task apprenticeship is that I went there, always wanted the best. Anything I do, always want to be the best at what I do, which is good in a sense. It's a downfall to cook, it's lots of old feelings for me. Although I achieve that, trying to compensate for something that's probably unattainable. And I went to Manan and got some service and made the tea. And I'm like, I've never made the tea for nobody. It's not in my DNA to make people tea. And I went down and made the tea, and I said to him, I've got a sponsor. That guy, he cooked me a steak and he loved me and he held me. I've got a sponsor and I've got some literature. He said, start the step work, do some writing. And I couldn't tell him, I couldn't read and write, so I couldn't tell him that. So I was just so embarrassed and humiliated. And the biggest fear just to be, have any more humiliation added to my bags of it. And that's what got to college. And I got through it and I've done some service at 89 to support prison. I want to take this message into prisons because I can't get out. And I know every time I come out of prison, in there, I wasn't going to use, but when I come out, I tend to be using. And they just plugged in doctors and institutions. And when look, the first 5 years of recovery, I spent it in service at 89 and I found it lovely, like a figure stuff. And it's worth maintenance. As you, life's been good to me, since been clean, got a family, job, and all that sort of stuff. And I maintain that own group of the, I do a meeting every Friday. I get to greet a newcomer, I get to meet a newcomer, say in the workplace, I get to kind of have a coffee there, some literature, and in the wrong place, man. I look back, so I feel it. Not indebted, that's the wrong word. But look, I have a moral obligation. It's done for me. And I'd ask anybody else to suffer when necessary. But I'm pretty passionate about recovery. Pretty passionate. And that's why I love this. I love the platform now that we get to speak openly and freely. But life is very shit, and I found a way to improve. Greatest gift, all my kind of like, trauma adversities, actually, more trauma adversities and hardship, you know, growing up become somebody's kind of strength and winning
Yeah.
that.
Yeah. It's almost like it becomes like your superpower, doesn't it? Which is bizarre. But I mean, and I know that you obviously work in the field now as well. So you started off volunteering in the sector, didn't you, initially? Was that right?
Yeah, I started volunteering, give me an ID badge. Give me an ID badge and I was like, I've made it. Yeah, no ID badge, I started banging on windows. I said, look, you need a script. Yep, I'm banging on windows. And service users would come in. Do you want a coffee? So I've never met a team alive, like, Met clients, or cups of coffee and cups of tea, and I'll go, yeah, and that's that gift, that's that feeling when I started volunteering. I find out I love helping people, I love
Mad, isn't
helping.
it, that like even just the I mean even me today, like just the feeling of a service user comes into the lobby and you say, you have a quick chat with them and say, do you want a brew, and you make them a cup of tea. The feeling of just giving that cup of tea and the appreciation that they have for you just making them that cup of tea, it's absolutely priceless. You don't get that from any material acquisitions in life.
And it's pretty selfish. I've looked at it, it's pretty selfish because me and me always in trouble, always hot. So I need to work on getting out of me. I need to work on getting out of me, do, because I'm just, I can't really talk myself at all. I've got years and years of experience. I shouldn't be trusting myself, but I used to think it was okay to steal and put needles in myself and that.
But you
So
can say that even in like I talk about this quite often actually in meetings and stuff like and this isn't my idea, this was passed on to me by somebody else, but they said, even in your own household, like when you go to make yourself a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, always make your partner and your kids a drink as well, so whenever I make a cup of coffee or tea for myself now, my wife's cup always goes down next to it. I always pour her water first. I always make her a cup of tea first before mine. And just in that act of doing that thing, it's like it's always like you said, it's separating me from me, and it's putting somebody else in front of me, and it's all the little things like wake up in the morning, let the dog out, the dog goes first. It's all these little tiny things that you think, you don't think that they have that much of an impact on your life, but they do. They're massively. If you can just keep continually think of others rather than think of yourself, that's half the battle.
I mean, I took people through the 12 steps and take people through the side of the bus, and I thought, well, you need to be passing that on now. Should be, if you do, you need to be passing that on. And really happy, I think, only you could see how happy I was. I'm probably more happier taking someone through the 12 steps than now that actually getting through the 12 steps.
Yeah.
It's surreal.
Yeah.
And that's what, look. I was really blessed. I was really fortunate to go to a 12-step fellowship in the corner of my truck to it, like a duck to water. And that's one of the platforms like this where people say, oh, there should be loads of platforms. People can get well, people can help each other. I don't just help people in 12-step fellowship, that gives me the tools to help people. Or anywhere we go,
Yeah.
as long as I'm not myself.
Well, I think that, that with things like this, I mean, yeah, that's I suppose what I always hope with this podcast is that, just somebody will hear it. It could be just one person that hears this conversation that it helps, and it might help them to either make a decision to go to a meeting or, just do make a little change in their life, or maybe they've got a partner or a friend or someone that needs help, like it might help them understand other people's suffering. And I just think that the more open we are about our lives in recovery, the more that of a ripple effect there can be out into society in general.
And that's a lot of things, but also educating other people. But we have so many colleagues who work with where say educating sounds, got to speak openly. No longer we live without guilt and shame of who it was. I don't. You can feed back now again, but don't live with that old person, kind of, today I get up and I'll do, try what I can, I'll do what I can. And I'm my own little personal amends. I do a lot of work with the police, and I thought, I have a lot on the amends to the police. And I do a lot of stuff to kind of, educate a lot of professionals. People talk about my past, they think, you're having me on. I went, no, I used to inject my toilet water. I used to use vinegar to inject me. And you think I'm joking? No. So I think it's really intriguing to get that message out there that people do change and change. Change is
Yeah,
possible.
change is it's possible, isn't it? Change is achievable because you're a perfect example of it.
And there's loads of stuff I'd like to promote where we can change through, adversity. Look, growing up, my mum and dad was in solid Catholic units. When we used to go to see my mum in the female unit, and I'd pop over to see my dad in the male solid Catholic unit. the birthday section. I spoke about abuse, all aspects of abuse. You know, family, and I said I lost my daughter to addiction. It's how you don't know you do get away to addiction. I have a family, and I've got a daughter who I haven't seen. No real stuff, what kind of real bogs you down. Stuff where you can take to the grave, you never good, but you never going to share it with anybody. You should feel so shameful about it. And that's what a lot to the people know. But that stuff is taking you to the grave. You're not taking that to the grave. That stuff is taking you to the grave. It will hurt. Guys, the people you can talk to, the people you can kind of share that burden with. And that's about the magic of life, and people I could share more burden, more guilt, more shame, remorse. And what would alleviate like that? So heavy it was. You know, it got really heavy, really.
Undoubtedly, for me, the greatest barrier to, you know, to asking for help in my own life, and I see in it, in anybody's life really, is pride.
Still more people than drugs.
Yeah, it really has.
First side, things of practice. Ego, trying to keep my ego in check. I've seen lots of people fall short and we trip up over ego. Just saying, ego is the anesthesia, but we're dead in the pan, stupidity. I remember that, always remember that saying. Keep my ego in check. Humble, I don't forget where I come from. I don't forget. Each time it keeps being on, just even being shaped. But I don't forget none of that. There's nothing special about me. There's nothing. And that's the main things upon practice, come to anything, humility, a bit of compassion, a bit of always trying to keep that at the forefront of my thinking.
Yeah. Well, it's I suppose the aim is to just be a person amongst people, isn't it? And not to be greater or less than anybody really, and just I suppose the measure of a person's self-worth and self-esteem is how they feel about themselves in comparison to others really. You know, if you can genuinely say, I don't want to be anybody else, I'm happy being me. You know, I'm not better than anybody else, and I'm no worse than anybody else, and I'm just a person that, you know, does the best he can. Then I think that's pretty much the best you can hope for, really. Because everything else that I've ever tried, which, you know, like any ego fueling pursuit that I've ever gone down that route, it just never works out for me. It just makes me feel terrible. And I always end up having to medicate myself then with other things. So whether it's food, chocolate, sweets, you know, sex, whatever, you know, anything that will change the way that I feel that isn't alcohol and drugs, I can quite easily go down that route. And it is usually when my ego's kind of taken control again.
What do I class myself as? Since I know I've got a fragile ego, very fragile. I always compare myself to academics, and something I look at, something I need to work on. I have a colleague sitting next to me, she talks about 4,000 words a minute. I'm a loser. You know what I mean? My sledgehammer, two fingers. Going back to earlier when I said, Lord, I won't change a thing. I'm like, you know, I'm okay today. This is the way I am. I'm okay with where I come from. It's
That's really important, actually. I mean, it's important to just dwell on that for a second. Is the importance of not regretting the past or wishing to shut the door on it? You know, it's like the past is the past, but the past got you to where you are today. And, you know, everybody's story, no matter how harrowing certain parts of it may be, if it's a recovery story, it's a story of survival, and it's a story of surviving and thriving, as they say, isn't it? You know, you've survived the worst of it, and now you're in the thriving part, and that is you know, in the same way that that bloke inspired you, and you wanted a bit of what he has, you're now doing that for other people, which is amazing.
you must have said once you have it, you can arrive. Just to touch on, obviously, I do believe for me it was important in order for me to move forward in my life, but to go back with that. So I believe moving forward in my life, I had too much stuff carrying too much weight, carrying too much like guilt, shame, the most. I realized it wasn't mine to carry from a young age, or carrying stuff from a young age. It didn't belong to me. And we responded to our current work through the 12 steps. And I got to a stage where he says, maybe have some training, maybe have some external lab now. And I got to a step four and went and sourced some therapy. To kind of all work together with it is really good, how he says, and you get to a certain part, you'll have a break, and you're going to do some. Done decent stuff, and so I think it's important to me in order to move forward, my lord, and get rid of a lot of baggage. I had to go back first and clean up properly,
Yeah.
get all cleaners in where needed.
Yeah.
It's
Well,
good.
it sounds like you had a really good sponsor and someone that could, you know, like the value of that, of not only, I mean, the whole point of the steps is to clear away the wreckage of the past, isn't it? And to enable you to have that spiritual awakening, so that you can then help other people. But at the same time, if you need outside help, you know, to kind of sift through. Especially if you've, you know, you've experienced the things like you had with the sexual abuse, and obviously, like, sounds like a very chaotic and traumatic kind of household. A sponsor that isn't qualified, you know, to deal with that kind of stuff is probably best to just hand your care over to someone else for a little bit or during the process, so that you can work through that stuff. And I totally agree because I had exactly the same experience. You know, I did the same thing. I went and saw, few counselors over a period of about 2 or 3 years and worked through some stuff, and it was really, really valuable. You know, I'd highly recommend it. Just finding the right person that can help you.
What do you always want to say? So, if your car was broken, Nicholas, you wouldn't take it to a butcher to fix it, would you?
Yeah.
You'd take it to the right. So, that's what story probably saying doom and gloom and stuff. And that's important. You know, once I stopped taking drugs, I had a chance, I had a fighting chance. I always thought we stopped taking one drug, we stopped injecting heroin and crack and just smoke cannabis. I'll be okay. And it's never the case. Never the case. And kind of, in order to stop taking, and your son says, "Did you ever know drugs was illegal?" So that should have been enough to stop you in the
Like that doesn't even come into the equation.
say to clients now, having some banter and having a joke, no drugs were illegal.
It's like as if that is even as it even comes into your mind at any point. You know, oh, this stuff's illegal, I shouldn't be doing it. It's like, no, it's what it works. That's the point. It does what I want it to do, which is it completely either. Takes me to oblivion and wipes me out, so I don't have to think about anything. Or at the least, it helps me to avoid my feelings and my thoughts.
And now sometimes, look, avoidance, we never avoid it, we suppress it, we just get to escape it. And the scene comes back, and it comes back with a lot more guilt,
Yeah.
a lot more kind of self shame of self. And
I think that's another important thing as well, is that you've mentioned, because you've mentioned it numerous times, is guilt and shame. You know, think people, especially people who aren't necessarily in any sort of formal recovery, they kind of think, oh, like I've got, you know, this guilt and shame there that I can never get rid of and I can never overcome it. And like you said, you know, you're carrying all this stuff around with you, but there are ways of lightening that load and actually completely getting rid of that load in most cases. If you're willing to put in the work, it isn't easy, but you know, and you have to talk about it. And once you've spoken about it, you can overcome it.
I missed that part of school. We should set up or left almost left school before they kind of taught us, say, how difficult life is gonna be when older. But yeah, so missed that part of school.
They
Thank
definitely didn't tell you that in school. That's the that's. That is something that they don't cover, do they?
yes, and never kind of never even know understanding of how difficult life is gonna be, and I kind of how to process my feelings and kind of my emotions. That's going to affect me, now it's going to kind of close me off to stuff. And I thought it was wrong with all my life, because you have thoughts and you have these kind of feelings. And but wow, I could never talk to anybody. This is not the case. I found some beautiful people I can talk to. And he taught me laugh, and that's the laugh at me. And they said, "Lord, learn to laugh at yourself. One of the biggest best gifts you'll give yourself, learn to laugh at yourself.
Yeah, 100%. And what does life in recovery mean to you, Nick?
A lot more than laughing in academic addiction. And you could always have, but speak to people always have, or my brother time, I should have been dead years ago. People with more kind of really don't make it or come out of. And precious, life's precious. So when I got clean, I was still educated. Some people are getting re-educated. I'm like, I wasn't educated in the first place. Look, people come to me and say, I lost everything to the addiction and that. Well, man, I come here, I didn't lose anything, but I didn't have nothing to lose. But come here. Yeah, got educated, got a job, and I found a job that I like, found a job I can be a good feeling. And I met a partner like 5 years ago. And he had a son, and he had a daughter who's about 7. And when I got with her, we separated about 2 months ago. We went through a separation, and really healthy separation, which is so surreal. So it's abnormal. I've had worse separations, but yeah, I finally called good. It's given me everything, everything I've ever wanted, John. But she's saying things, actually, I haven't got that what I wanted. I haven't got that. No, there's nothing I haven't got what I didn't want. And so I didn't want to be a millionaire. I don't want to be a famous what. I wanted a job. I wanted a family. I wanted to be a productive member of my society, of the community. I wanted to be that pillar where people can come to me and I kind of go, yeah. We met a beautiful partner. We had a son. We separated a couple of months back because she made the decision it's not working. Okay, kids are okay. Started the school one. In the school one this morning. I set my alarm clock and extra thing. Yeah, when the school holidays, you just kind of I'm out of routine and need a routine again. Took my daughter, I stepped daughter to school this morning. And stuff like, I suppose, share stuff like that, stuff that I would have used on anything, I would have took your children on any feeling or emotion. I suppose as the years go by, you kind of you acquire this strength, or stamina, this kind of emotional capacity to. I'm not going to use it. I'm not going to use it. I've separated. I've still got responsibilities. I've still got commitments. I've still got my service position in NA. Still got sponsors. I've got kids to look after, which is life's magical. Life is hard. I wouldn't give anybody the BS that life is kind of you stop taking drugs and life you just sail off into the sunset. It's not. Life's difficult with people in addiction. We know. Life can be quite difficult and challenging. And that's what I found. I found the place where I went. I found all the people who don't use on these challenges in life. And I've seen people go through horrific things that they haven't picked up, they haven't used. It turns up and they've spoke about it and it turns and spoke about it. And some sick of, not me recently, sick of hearing my own voice. And I turn up and talk about it. People reach out to me. When I have safety numbers, always thought it's me against the world, me against the world. I mean, always I'm using drugs, even that's not excellent sort of thinking. I don't think I've experienced love, so I come into a couple of John. I've people in my life who've shown me love and unconditional love and the recovery to me sense of incredible. I talk about all the gifts, all the financial, all the being abroad, all that sort of stuff. You know, fundamental. Honor values is what people love me and care about me. I have capacity to love people and care about people. But when I got my partner, she had a 7-year-old who was petrified. I thought, man, I'm still eating out of tins. I'm about 4 years clean. I was eating out of tins. I was like, my brother said to me, look, all the Ramsay, got all the stuff in the kitchen. But then there's a part I think. You're not allowed to use any. Look, I only bought tins when I could open that. I'd only eat more crave. So I just didn't have that ability to kind of. It was in my own flat, I was working on the eight, so it looked like I was proper. I'd go home, I think, I just had one plate on the side, one fork, one knife, it looked like I was in prison.
Yeah.
We call that in backpacks. My first 2 years in Earth in the corporate. I had an old AA chair and get up and make a bed. First achievement, first commitment in the morning, get up and make a bed. So we're done. Yeah, recovery meetings, it's a lot of stuff for recovery meetings. Also, I was at my mum's yesterday, she's lovely. She's annoying. She did manage to do absolutely difficult things. You have to just stomach it, you have to just find a fold and stuff. Yeah, mum. Yeah. Some beautiful relationships. I could go on all day about this stuff, Lord. It's, when I found my self-esteem, I found my self-worth, that I was important enough to maintain relationships. I was worth having a relationship. People start coming to you. People, what you do seems to be attracted to people. And so, well, I don't need any more friends. I can't manage the ones I've got. And it took me some years. It took me some years to get the barriers down. You know, to get them all down. Maybe a few years. And I trust. I'd love trust. Blind faith, as they call it. The blind faith. My trust has never been abused. Whether that's love, whether that's I've never had my trust abused in any kind of or mismanaged. Oh. But I love John. I'm really blessed. I love him a lot. And a passport, a birth certificate, and holidays, and cars, and jobs, and debts, kids.
That's amazing, mate. Well, thank you very much for sharing your story with us today, because I found it very inspirational, and I'm sure many people will. So yeah, just wanted to say all the best and thanks very much for that.
John, just mention.
Yeah.
Thank you for your time as well. And thank you for being in the podcast and kind of getting the message out there. And I know you have a family, a job, you have a lot going on in your life, and you've found time to do this. So thank you, really.
Appreciate that. Thanks very much, Nick. Cheers, mate.
My pleasure.